Paul Brown and I accomplished at Midland.
Just trying to get it. Missed a few comments here when we changed the tape. Did you ever have the opportunity, you stayed in research your entire career at Midland. Did you ever have the opportunity to move into away from research? Did that in your
Well, I never looked for it. And I don't know whether they were looking for special. I was considered a senior scientist out there, of course, and this was satisfactory to me. I never... a lot of the people... there is this problem that you see when you're closer to it, that people in research, it takes longer to develop things and to see accomplishment in research. And a lot of the people that get into research, they see these other guys and they're probably making more money and all of this. It gets into the picture, and maybe I could have gone into the management aspect of the thing. But, and I know I talked with some of the psychologists that they bring in to analyze. I never really thought too much of this business, and I think it was really my preference to stick to research. It looked like, well, I know that they're all essential if you need these people, but it looked like something too far away. I mean, something that wasn't definite, something that where you really didn't. The guts of the thing, and the thing that really counts is things that are being done in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. I think that was part of my attitude. It never bothered me. A lot of the people, and these people that came in to work with me, some of them were, they just wanted to get out of research and get into production or sales or something, because they figured that's where the money was. And so, but I think it's different now. They've got... what they've gradually did was build a different ladder, a scientific ladder, a more academically oriented ladder, if you want to talk about senior scientists and a lot of times you would think, well, that's just a kind of a nicety. They give people titles that they like, but it's more than that. I think it's a recognition of some of these skills and abilities that go into the technical aspects of a problem. And I always, these people are just as dedicated, whether they're selling or whether they're in the accounting department, a lot of those people are just as dedicated and essential to the progress of a company and its growth as anybody else. It isn't a one-way thing. Whenever, you know, if I got interested in something, I had trouble. I wanted to do it myself. I wanted to find out firsthand what was cooking. So I always had a little trouble that way. You can't compete with people that are working for you or with you. And it takes a lot of people in all these areas to make a success out of a thing like Dow Corning. So,
how would you contrast the two companies, Corning and Dow Corning, in terms of companies to work for?
You know, in a way, they have a similar background as far as company organization and build-up is concerned. Dow was a private-owned company for a while, and so was Corning. That was when Corning went... they were private up to around 1938 or so. Then they went to the stock market because they needed more money for expansion. And so in many ways, it's it was the Dow family, and here it was the Houghton family that in the glass business. But they also had men coming in like Dr. Sullivan, trained scientists, and I think Dr. Sullivan, to me, was a physicist, or a physical chemist, but I guess, you know, for quite a while he was editor-in-chief of the CNE News.
Oh, really?
Dr. Sullivan. He got the Perkin Medal in 29, I think, for his work on in developing the Pyrex glass. But his father, what was it, the Chicago Tribune? His father was, seems to me, was the editor of one of the big Chicago magazines. Oh. I'm not sure. There may be some of that in this other... But he was a gentleman through and through, and he appreciated research work, and he knew that everything wasn't going to be a ringer. And he had patience, and there was times when I thought, geez, I'm not doing myself or Corning either much good. You know, you get some things go backwards a little bit, you know, you begin to feel, well, am I doing something useful? You begin to feel that way. But Dr. Sullivan was always an encouragement. You could talk with him and he'd give you some, you'd feel, go over to his office and talk a little while with him, he'd come out feeling pretty good. He was that kind of a person. Never talked very much. What he said, though, was usually something worth listening to.
Sounds like an ideal person to work for.
Yeah, and Dr. Britton, I never knew too much about him, but I think Dr. Sullivan went to the University of Michigan before he went to Europe. And he went to Göttingen, for one thing.
Well, when you were at Dow Corning, did you know Britton at all? Did you? He was over at Dow. So
he was over at Dow, and of course I had met him when he came down to Corning. And then I'd visited his laboratory on several occasions and met some of the other people that were involved and got involved in some of the organosilicon work out there. But I knew of him earlier than that, because in 1932 at an ACS meeting that was held at Cornell University, he gave a paper involving the preparation of phenol from chlorobenzene. And boy, that's one of the things that you used to get marked off your paper. That was too simple, you know. So I knew of Britton from that. I remember it. He gave this paper. And,
interesting.
I remember marking it off on somebody's paper myself because it was impossible.
Well, I think we've covered an enormous amount of material. And is there anything else in your notes that you had there that you thought we might discuss?
Well, I did the two things here. On the end, I've forgotten where I. Oh, I.
This was the other one.
Yeah. This is what I figured. I thought maybe the things that I thought were important, maybe I should list that way.
Okay.
And I thought that maybe those would be things that... I think I included here. One of the things that you asked about were my opinions on... Yeah, that was one of the things that there's one more aspect to the research that we were doing. Paul Brown was involved in this. The thing in back of it was, again, to try and synthesize structures with greater precision. In other words, this bond rearranging thing that gives you shuffles everything was not the way to make some kinds of material. And one of the very reactive, there's another interesting thing that they've never capitalized on. The cyclic trimer is probably the cyclic tetramer of dimethyl is one of the most stable siloxanes comparable to a chain linear material. And the cyclic trimer is very reactive relatively. And you can treat the cyclic trimer with a much milder catalyst that is relatively non-bond rearranging and take it to a polymer. And so in one sense, and then another thing that we learned to do was to react that with another chlorosilane under relatively non-bond rearranging conditions and make special chlorosilane siloxane structures. This was one of the things that came out of it, and of course I still hope that we'll make better materials. I think that already some of this is getting into the works. Research has a slow, getting it into a useful area is a slow process. Once a process is set up and the people that are running it, their mind is on turning out a lot of stuff. They don't want anybody messing it up for them. So it's not easy to get research into a place where it'll improve the process or improve the product or something. So these are long-range things that happen gradually. When they get into trouble, you can help them. This is one of the jobs of research, I think. But and that's another thing with this bond rearranging. This is an interesting aspect of making polymers of the siloxane system. Every one, the dimethyl polymer, when it gets to an if you take it to an equilibrium condition where all the bond rearranging is kind of ended, you'll have about 15% of cyclics in there. If it's the diethyl, you'll have more like 30%. If it's the phenylmethyl, it'll still be a different percent of cyclics. And this is one of the interesting things that Dr. Johansson straightened out for him. With the trifluoropropyl methyl, it polymerizes so fast and depolymerizes again so fast that they never knew they had a polymer in between. This is one of the interesting things that Dr. Johansson straightened them all on that. Now they make good polymers with the what they call their LS intermediates. I don't know whether that's they probably still make use of that. I would guess that they do. And so this difference in the amount of cyclics tells us something about the effect that the various groups have on the silicon. And that's another thing that the diphenyl, if you want to make a diphenyl polymer, I'm not sure they still know how to do it. Because probably at equilibrium, if you didn't use some dodge or some condensation system, you would probably have 95% cyclics and 5% polymer. It might be one of the reasons that could, and of course that's one of the things that we're after with this non-rearranging system, was to develop mild catalysts, condensation catalysts, so that they'd tie them together. Not only that, but then you could put different siloxanes in there and make block copolymers with a non-bond rearranging system. This was one of the things that we had in mind with the research that we were doing towards the end of my career, if you want to call it that. I still worked till I was 70. I don't know whether they were wanting to get rid of me or not. But
it doesn't sound like it if they kept you on that long.
Well, anyhow, it was 72 when I was 72 when we moved here. So I was working really part-time, if you want to put it that way. That's about the situation. Now, it's a little harder to find people doing exploratory or basic research. A lot of these very competent people are tied up in these different areas. Of course, there's nothing wrong with that. These guys have the insight and know-how, but it doesn't help over the horizon, if you want to put it that way. I mean, there needs to be more. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that in a way either, because sometimes the customer finds out what's wrong with your product, and that's a good source of learning something new about it. So there's, I'm not criticizing from the point of view of they're doing that, but I just, there needs to be more people that are not tied down to it. And that was the way I was pretty well. Nobody tried to say, well, you're off in the wrong direction, let's go this way. And usually I think we were turning out in our lab useful things, which was one of the things in the uppermost of my mind. I was curious about things, and if I didn't understand them, that was a good start for some research too. And so that was part of the game. And there's still, I don't know whether I could jot them down, but I think that this place is still open for new interesting things and new discoveries and possibly new uses for the materials. It's already in uses that we never dreamed of back in those days. I think that every one of these Xerox machines has got some silicone in it. It's an insulating type. I don't know just how it's used, but it's gotten into so many places. And now one of the big things, of course, they're trying to get rid of these chlorinated biphenyls and things that are hard to get rid of in the nature. And silicones are getting in there and filling the bill for immersion fluids for transformers and things like that. So looks like there's no end to the... But I like to think that here's silicon. It's we've added another dimension to its usefulness in a way, because here it's the basis for all the mineral silicates, and then it's the basis for all the glasses, or not all of them, but the majority of them. And it's the basis of semiconductors, and here we've added another dimension to the usefulness of silicon, and that's more than ever puts it right in the middle of the period chart, as far as I'm concerned. I drew these lines. A lot of people objected to those lines that I drew through the center, but what they're for is to help emphasize that they're the two, and also color, that they're the two subgroups, A and B. And I thought we ought to leave them in there. And so they did. They've sold something like over 10,000 of those things at $3 a part, $3 a piece is, I think, about what it costs to get them printed.
Are they sold through Dow Corning?
Yeah. Dow Corning is, as far as I know, are the only ones that sell them. But I had these... on the end here, a continuing research program was directed towards developing non-bond rearranging synthetic methods for more precise structure building, offering the possibility of new products and not otherwise available. And in this work involved Terry Swihart, Dr. James Hampton, as well as others. And golly, there's so much. In such an enterprise, the individual contributions are so intertwined that separation of individual contributions are impossible. I mean, that's true. You're working closely together with people, and everybody adds their... Mm-hmm. Along with recognition by Corning and Dow of the importance of research, the dedicated effort of many people along the way has brought success and growth to Dow Corning. This includes all phases essential to the successful operation of a chemical company. The computer and many new analytical tools are marvels to behold and have advanced not only our research capabilities, but our technology and manufacturing capabilities enormously as well. Without them, Dow Corning would have difficulty operating at all. This is true, I think. The shortest path to new and better products is an insight into the basic principles in the background of a project. Well-directed research is the life insurance of an industry. And scientific facts never get obsolete. Only our misconceptions do in the light of new knowledge. Molecules always do what they're supposed to under a given set of conditions. To gain new knowledge and to fill the blank spots in our understanding of ourselves and our environment and to make it useful are worthy goals. For the person who wants to explore and discover, the field of chemistry is wide open. Along with minerals, glass, and semiconductors, the silicones have added another dimension to the usefulness of the silicon atom. At the present time, patents and publications number in the thousands, and there is many interesting and useful things still to be done. You know, they had the last international, they had one international silicon symposium at Midland. I've forgotten the date of it now. But I think the last one was at GE. And there was something like 200 people or more there for that symposium from all over the world. So it's really gotten pretty big.
It's come a long way from...
Never would have dreamed some of those things would happen.
When you first read Kipling's papers.
That's right. But it's... I still think, well, gosh, there's a lot of things that I should have gotten done that I never did.
Well, but you have an enormous amount of work to your credit with your papers and your patents.
Well, it was a lot of fun, but there was a lot of people involved and a lot of hard work by a lot of people, too. That motor program was a tough one. Grant and Dexter wound up with traction motors that were running at 250 degrees centigrade for I don't know how long. And so there isn't any question but what, in the long run, it added something very useful. So it wasn't in vain.
No, absolutely not. Well, is there anything else that you think we should cover at this point?
And McGregor wrote a book on the, what was it? I've forgotten now. We got a pretty big what would you call it? Down at Hemlock, not biomedical or medical applications, and that was pretty much up McGregor's alley. I mean, he spent quite a bit of time in that area. And one of the interesting things that happened was that they used to test materials. Dow is big at this kind of thing. They don't want to hurt people. They want to put products out that is going to cause them trouble. So Dow spends about $150 million a year checking and testing products. Dow Corning got into some of this, and they found that a little bit of a crude phenylmethyl, some of the residues in the bottom of a spray can, one of these pressure spray cans, were kept them from rusting. But they got into a little bit of a jam. It turned out when they done rabbit tests that there was some biological physiological activity to this stuff. And what it did was have a similar effect to an estrogen. I don't know what estrogen, but I guess it was a mild thing. But they started digging into it, and there was everything but the kitchen sink in this residue. So they started trying to separate, and of course, without GLC, which spread these things out, you know, it would have been an impossible thing. But they had some crystalline residues from way back that, I don't know, some of them had been distilled, but they were still pretty complex mixtures. But we started looking through some of them, and some of the fractions began to show some activity that the other ones didn't. It began to limit things a little bit. But finally, out of one of the stuff crystallized, now there was a lot of people involved, it just wasn't us in our laboratory, but this crystal material was apparently fairly pure, and it looked like it would be a cyclic, mixed cyclic with two phenylmethyls and two dimethyl groups in it in paraposition. And it turned out that the one that showed some biological activity was the cis. The trans didn't show it. But we finally got these things out, and then we synthesized some of them. In our laboratory, we finally dug out the, and it wasn't, there was other people involved, and I couldn't name all of them now, but it began to look, then they began to test it on getting it pure. Then they set up this bio laboratory, of course, in Midland, and Dr. Bennett was the first manager of that place. But then they set up rabbit animal tests, and this one particular thing was it was a 2,4 cis diphenylcyclic, the rest methyl groups. And they finally got around to the point of testing that in Sweden. People with the terminally ill prostate cancer. And what it did apparently was it didn't cure anything, but it relieved some of the pain and suffering that they were having, so that these people could go home and somehow or other the synthesis was too complex, and when they tried to get once something is approved by FDA, you can't change it with under any circumstances practically, and I think it got too expensive to try to synthesize it, and for what the benefit could be derived from it, so they quit doing it. I don't. I wasn't involved except that we. Part of our group managed to isolate the material and synthesize some of the material. It was not a good commercial synthesis, let's put it that way.
I'm just going to